This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents The English Wife by Lauren Willig. Read for you by Barry Krynick. Prologue. Cold Spring, 1899. Twelfth Night.
They say he's bankrupted himself rebuilding the house. All for her, of course.
Carrie Rhinelander's voice carried along the high-arched ceiling.
And then there are those frightful stories about... Oh, Janie! I didn't see you there.
No one ever did. Sometimes Janie felt like the threads on an old tapestry, blending into the background. That backdrop served its own purpose, Janie knew, but once, just once, she wished she could blaze out in a luster of silver and gold. But not here. Here everyone glittered, everyone blazed. Her brother's guests dazzled in garb that would have put a Medici to shame. Every breast adorned with diamonds and rubies, every neck hung round with gold chains. The men peacocked in tights and short cloaks, the women dazzled in silks and velvets woven with gold and sewn with jewels. Janie's own costume seemed modest in comparison, the garnets set in and around the squared neckline subdued in their opulence, the poor cousin of rubies.
Carrie?
Janie acknowledged Carrie's greeting with a shy nod. They had played dolls together, made their debut together, but Carrie had no time for her now. Carrie had married, and Janie hadn't. Against that, all the bonds of kinship and childhood counted as nothing. Carrie lifted a jeweled hand in acknowledgement, but she was already sailing past.
"Poor Janie Van Dyvel," she murmured to her companion. "All that money and still on the shelf."
A backwards glance and a hushed comment from Carrie's companion, one of the new people, the wife of a man who had made his money in mines. Then Carrie's voice again, a carrying whisper that was worse than a shout.
"Hardly. There's been no one, no one at all, since Teddy Newland jilted her for Anne."
Janie forced herself to focus on the array of sweetmeats on the buffet table. Hothouse grapes spilled off the edges of platters of ornate silver gilt. Strawberries, red and ripe out of season, glistened with sugar like flowers under frost. Bay and Annabel had spared no expense in this, their one bow to society. A bow? No, more like the glorious condescension of monarchs, throwing open the palace for a day, letting the world come and gawk before slamming shut the gates and returning to their own quiet state. Bay and Annabel had made a point of shunning society, or at least that was how society saw it. The idea that they might simply prefer their own company was taken as nonsense. It was sheer affectation that drove Annabel Van Dyvel to ignore Mrs. Astor's invitations to leave empty the family box at the opera. It was, everyone agreed, all the fault of her being English and convinced of her own superiority. Just look at what she had done to the Van Dyvel family home on the Hudson. A simple house of white wood, with a mere three wings and a classical colonnade, had been abandoned in favor of a baronial fantasy, a replica of Mrs. Van Dyvel's family home in England.
"If she liked it there that much, why couldn't she have stayed there?" muttered the matchmaking mamas, thwarted in their ambitions for their daughters. But they came anyway, all of them, in their private train cars, their landaus, their barouches, footmen in livery riding atop piles of baggage, ladies' maids clutching jewel cases, eager to gawk at what Annabel Van Dyvel had wrought, to cluck their tongues and shake their heads and spread what scandal they could as they dined on their host's food and reputations.
"Van Dyvel doesn't trust his wife in society. That's why they're never in town. On account of her intemperate appetites."
Right next to her, Janey could hear the unmistakable bray of Alastair McHugh, self-appointed social arbiter. It was an open secret that McHugh snuck stories to Town Topics, the notorious scandal sheet. No one dared shun him for fear of what he might invent.
The architect's her lover, of course. Hadn't you heard? Right under her husband's nose, no less, and Van Dyvel footing the bill for the renovations.
Janey didn't know whether to blush for her brother or his guests. Annabelle's not like that, she wanted to say. They're neither of them like that. But her tongue felt like ice between her lips, frozen, as it always was in such situations.
Don't make a scene. Don't put yourself forward. For goodness sake, Janey, stop that tiresome chatter.
Those had been the strictures of her youth. Mr. McHugh might spread scandal all he liked, but if Janey were to contradict him, the world would whisper, "No wonder she's a spinster."
Where were Bay and Annabelle?
Janey could see her mother, wearing the double ropes of pearls that were her pride, dressed as Gloriana.
Gloriana in her later years, thought Janey, and then grimaced at her own pettiness.
But it was very much like her mother to claim the primary role in a house that was no longer hers, masking her own ambition behind the excuse that her presence would lend countenance to her son and daughter-in-law. Janey's mother considered herself the last of the true leaders of society, the last bastion of the old guard against those tedious mushroom growths, the Astors and the Vanderbilts. There were times when Janey thought it might be rather nice to be a mushroom, to grow and flourish without the steely gaze of centuries of Dutch ancestors. Virtue, her mother told her time and again, was its own reward. But on a night such as this, virtue seemed about as much a reward as day-old porridge. There were times when she wished she had been born a male, that she might make her own way, that she might marry as she pleased, and live as she would. But that was as much a fancy as this carnival version of the Renaissance. In a few hours the jester in motley would take off his cap and become an actor again. Isabella of Spain would ring for her maid and put cold cream on her face, and the whole pageant would turn again into what it was— hard-eyed businessmen and their ambitious wives, scheming to attain the status to which Janey and Bay had been born, and which had offered them nothing but the right to be gossiped over.
Janey!
It was her cousin Anne, breathless and impatient, her cheeks flushed with heat, or something else.
Janey!
Yes?
Next to Anne, Janey felt like the faded copy of an old portrait, set beside the glowing tones of the original. They both had blonde curls as girls, but where Janey's had faded to mouse, Anne's was glowing, unapologetic gold. Anne had chosen her own namesake for her costume. She had dressed as Anne Boleyn.
"Are you sure it's wise?"
Janey had heard Bay ask as the family gathered for dinner.
"To call their minds to divorce?"
Anne had lifted a caressing hand to Bay's cheek, her laugh just a touch too bright.
"When have you and I ever been wise?"
Now Anne's headdress was askew, and twin lines of irritation marked the sides of her mouth.
"Have you seen Bay and Annabelle? Supper's nearly over, and they're meant to be opening the German."
"They're not in the music room?"
Annabelle, when she chose to share it, had a beautiful voice. It was a talent she used charily, although Janey had more than once heard her sister-in-law's voice, low and sweet, through the darkened entry to the night nursery.
"No, nor in the card room or the conservatory. Don't you think I've looked?"
Anne sounded deeply impatient, but then Anne always sounded impatient, at least with Janey.
"They're not with you?"
Realizing how idiotic that sounded, Janey said hastily,
"I'd thought Bay was with you."
It had always been Bay and Anne, from the time they were children, creating elaborate theatricals, keeping each other's secrets, speaking in grimaces and symbols that only the other understood. Janey's childhood had consisted of the echo of laughter from another room, the rustle of fabric disappearing around a doorway, voices that faded as she pursued them. But they were adults now, all of them. She wasn't the baby in the nursery anymore.
"He needed to consult David over something or other."
Anne's voice was tense.
"There's to be a spectacle in the gardens at midnight. David designed it."
It was like Anne to use the architect's first name, regardless of propriety. But then, Anne would probably say she had no reputation left to lose.
"Then shouldn't you be asking Mr. Prine?"
Janey was aware of how priggish she sounded, but she couldn't help it. Something about Anne brought the prunes and prisms out in her, made her purse her lips and narrow her shoulders. Anne cast her a withering look.
"I did. He said Bay went to find Annabelle."
The whimsy of it struck Janey.
"It's like a children's game, everyone following everyone else."
Anne was not amused.
"Do you want to explain to Aunt Alva why the dancing is delayed?"
The invocation of Janie's mother was enough to kill any hint of humor.
"Has Mother said anything?"
"Who do you think sent me?"
Janie and her cousin exchanged a look, united in reluctant partnership. It would have been like Annabelle to have gone up to the children, but if she tilted her head, Janie could see two small figures in white nightdresses between the heavily carved balusters of the minstrel's gallery, the shadowy shape of a nursemaid behind them.
"Did you say there's to be a spectacle in the garden?"
No point in being hurt that Anne knew more than she. Anne always knew more than she. Doubtfully, Janie said,
"They might have gone to supervise."
Her mother would have. Her mother would have personally managed every aspect of the entertainment. Annabelle had never struck her as that sort of hostess. Still, what did she know of Annabelle? For all that Annabelle was her brother's wife, they had never proceeded beyond a polite reserve. It wasn't that Annabelle was unkind, just distant, like the image of the moon reflected on water. Janie wasn't sure whether the fault was with Annabelle or herself. She suspected the latter. For whatever reason, she didn't have the gift of easy intimacy. There was no one in the world Janie counted as truly an intimate, except for the characters that lived beyond the pages of the plays in her father's library.
"Come along, then."
Anne was already moving towards the back of the hall, her heels clicking rapidly on the flagstones.
"Outside?"
"No, to Sherry's. Yes, outside."
Footmen in livery were stationed on either side of the door, which they opened without question or comment.
"Our wraps.
We'll just be a moment."
Anne's breath misted in the air. She moved sure-footed across the sleet-crusted flagstones, leaving Janie no choice but to follow or fall behind. Janie followed. The gardens had been hung with Chinese lanterns, creating sinuous lines of light in the dark, meandering pathways to the river. In the summer, the air would be rich with the scents of roses, jonquils, and carnations. Lavender would edge the paths, and knot gardens would bloom, fragrant with herbs. Now, hothouse flowers wilted in stone urns, their colors blurred by the light fall of snow that lent an otherworldly shimmer to the scene. The falling flakes seemed insubstantial, but they caught on Janie's lashes and blurred her vision, the snow and the lantern light casting rainbows at the corners of her eyes, turning the midnight gardens into something between fear and fairyland. The heavy brocade of her skirts tangled around her legs, impeding her progress. Janie's dancing slippers had been designed for marble floors, not ice and snow. She could feel the cold creeping through her stockings as she stumbled and slid in Anne's wake. Ahead of her, dancing in and out of view in the lantern light, she could see the reflection of the great house shivering on the river, all fanciful battlements and crenellations like the drowned towers of a mythical castle. For a moment, Janie thought she saw the form of a woman floating on the water, long dark hair streaming out behind her, skirts decorated in pearl and aquamarine, turning slowly to shades of gray as the water seeped into their folds. She turned again, and the image was lost, the house behind them just a house, the river hidden by the trees. Janie swiped a wet lock of hair from her face and wondered why she had let herself be cozened by Anne yet again, had allowed Anne to lead her where she shouldn't go, when Bay and Annabelle were undoubtedly warm and dry inside, opening the German, from which Anne and Janie would be conspicuously absent. They had battled their way through the length of the gardens. Ahead lay only the river and the folly, bare ruined choirs where monks had never sung, the false remains of an imagined abbey in a staunchly Protestant preserve. But then, in Illyria, nothing was as it was it?
Anne?
Janie blinked snow out of her eyes. The light was dimmer here. The arches of the abbey that never was had been left in deliberate darkness, save for two torches that sputtered in the wet. Where was her cousin? She could hear only her own voice, raised to shrillness against the deafening hush of the snow-shrouded garden.
Anne? I'm going back!
Oh, God! Oh, God! Oh, God!
The words would have sounded like a chant, like the echo of a long-ago refrain, were it not for the edge of panic to them.
Anne?
Janie's voice was sharp. She squinted into the glare of the lanterns, searching for the rope that might be stretched out to trip her, the snickering town beau waiting to jump out and scare her. Anne's voice rose from the darkness down by the folly.
Bay? Can you hear me? Bay!
Janie could feel panic rising, quickening her step as she half ran, half slid the final few yards to the folly, her hands like ice in her gloves, light flaring at the corners of her eyes, the strange gray half-dark of a snowy night pressing all around her. Anne was kneeling on the floor, her skirts spread all around her, cloth of gold turned to rust. The air was heavy with the scent of sulfur from the torches, and something else, an acrid tang that caught at the back of Janie's throat like smoke.
"What is it?"
Janie's voice echoed in the stony room. Anne rocked back on her heels, pressing a hand against her mouth.
"It's Bay. Oh, God. Bay. Bay.
What do you..."
A hand was extended as if in supplication, rings glittering on the fingers. Stage rings, designed for the occasion. Janie had seen those rings, had commented on them at dinner. It was Bay's hand, Bay's legs in elaborate knee breeches. Bay, on the ground. Janie dropped to her knees beside her brother, feeling the cold of the stones seeping through the thick material of skirt and petticoats. In the uneven flare of the torchlight, she could just make out the bright flare of his blonde hair, the pale shape of his face. Was it just a trick of the light, or were his lips tinged with blue? The ruins were open to the elements, a mere sham of a building. The wind blew cold off the river, scattering snow like diamonds. The spectacle. Something about a spectacle. Janie's mind stuttered and started again. Bandages. Medical assistance. It was no wonder if Bay had slipped and fallen on the icy stones. Janie reached for Bay's hand, so cold, even through the material of her gloves. She squeezed his fingers and felt him stir, ever so slightly.
Anne?
When her cousin didn't answer, Janie tried again, louder.
Anne, you go for help. I'll stay with Bay. We need to get him warm.
She had no shawl to lay over him, but her brocade overskirt detached from the underskirt. If she could only remember where her maid had set the stitches.
I think...
Anne rocked back on her heels and kept rocking, rocking back and forth. She laughed, a wild sound, somewhere between a laugh and a hiccup.
I think it's too late for that. Oh, Bay, 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 can you hear me? I'm so sorry. Bay, Bay... Anne, pull yourself...
The words died on Janie's lips as her eyes moved from her brother's face to his chest. to the jeweled hilt of a dagger protruding from his doublet. Her brother exhaled, a labored, rasping sound. With effort, his eyes flickered open, focusing not on Janie, but on something beyond. His lips moved, shaping a word, a name.
Bay!
Janie was squeezing his hand, squeezing as if the pressure of her touch could bring him back, hold him where he was.
Bay!
This wasn't happening. It was a game, a trick, part of the illusion. Any moment now he would pluck the dagger from his doublet and leap to his feet with easy grace. Just a trick, a scratch, nothing more. Ask for me tomorrow and you shall find me a grave man. Next to her, Anne was laughing, a high-pitched laugh that went on and on, keening and keening in the darkness.
Bay?
Her brother's head slumped back, his eyes closed, snow dusting the closed lids. Frantically, futilely, Janie brushed at the falling flakes.
Bay, this isn't funny!
Tricks were Anne's province, not Bay's. The smell of blood stung Janie's nostrils. Blood seeping into the velvet of Bay's doublet, trickling out of the corner of his mouth. And in the river below, the long, dark tresses of a woman shimmered gently below the ice. Chapter 1 New York, 1899, January. Knickerbocker murders wife and kills himself. Murder and suicide on the Hudson. It was impossible to ignore the headlines. They screamed out in bold black type from either side of the street, in the hands of newspapermen waving the latest editions.
Miss Van Dyvel! Miss Van Dyvel! Did you see him? Did you see the body? Miss Van Dyvel, did you know he was going to kill her?
Police had created cordons on either side of the front steps, keeping the press and sensation seekers at a distance. But they couldn't contain the sound of them, the babble and rumble of the crowd, pushing and clawing for a better view, shouting out questions and opinions. The family had managed to evade the reporters at Grace Church, but the house was another matter. A jostling crowd had been waiting for them when they returned from the funeral. Reporters and curiosity seekers, masses of them, mobs of them, wanting to get a look at the sensation of the hour, a proud old family brought low. It had been only a week since they had found Bay, but since then the story had whirled about them like a snowstorm, growing in force with every hour. All of the old nonsense had been dragged up, the whispers of Annabelle's affairs, Bay's jealousy, the adultery going on right beneath the marital roof. Lies, all of it, but so much more compelling than truth. And what was the truth? Janie had no more idea than they. She knew only that Bay could never have done what the papers claimed.
Miss Van Dyvel! Miss Van Dyvel! Is it true that he bashed her head in?
Janie buried her chin in her fur collar and kept moving. The Cold Spring constable hadn't believed her, not at first, when she said she'd seen a body in the water. He'd dismissed it as fancy, at least until they found that blue silk slipper on the bank. They hadn't found Annabelle's body, not yet. The ice was too thick, the water too deep. It might never be recovered. It that had once been a she. Janie could feel the beginnings of a headache pinching her temples. The noise, the clamor, it was all the stuff of nightmares. The past week was nothing but a bad dream. The funeral service, the flower-laden casket, the solemn pallbearers in their tall hats, the white-robed choristers, none of it had been real. Bay and Annabelle were at Elyria, sitting by the fire, the twins curled between them as Annabelle sang a lullaby, soft and low. She tried to picture it, but all she could see was Bay, sprawled on the floor of the folly, his lips forming one last word as Annabelle's body drifted beneath the ice, like something out of a painting by Mr. Millais. Janie didn't know what forces her mother had brought to bear to persuade the Putnam County coroner to release Bay's body. Officially, her mother was in deep mourning, seeing no one, speaking to no one, delegating all the official offices of death to the family lawyer. But a series of notes on black-bordered stationery had made their way from Mrs. Van Dyvel's desk to state senators and judges. And the coroner, who had initially hemmed and hawed and dithered, had discovered in himself unexpected depths of sensibility, issuing an interim certificate of death and postponing the inquest until such time as further information might be acquired.
"Miss Van Dyvel, did you see it? Did you see him stab her?"
Anne addressed the crowd over her fur-trimmed shoulder, saying in a carrying voice,
"Surely there must be a brawl at a beer hall somewhere in the city. Go find it. Or if not, I'm certain you'll have no trouble starting one."
The laughter from the crowd stung the journalist into retaliation. He jostled forward, pushing his way free from the crowd.
"Mrs. Newland, where's your husband?"
Anne went still, like a hunted animal, every sense on alert.
"Leave it," Janie whispered. "Just go inside."
But Anne didn't go. She turned, slowly and deliberately, letting the journalists and gawkers look their fill. A cousin wasn't required to shroud herself in black, so Anne had adopted half-mourning, a bold purple that suited her rose and gold coloring. The evening editions would be full of every detail of her dress, the cut and color provocatively Parisian against the frost-bleached New York street. The sketch artists were already at work, blowing on cold fingers to warm them. Anne looked the journalist up and down, her very pose a provocation. In a bored drawl, she said,
"Why don't you ask him?"
Janie tugged at her hand, but Anne didn't need tugging. She turned on her heel, sweeping into the house with one magnificent flounce of her skirt, leaving Janie to scurry along behind. In the parlor, the drapes were drawn and the lamps were lit. Night in the midst of day. Janie shivered in her furs. They weren't to have returned until Monday, and the house still had the chill of emptiness about it. Or maybe it was a different sort of hollowness entirely. Janie's mother looked up from the mirror by the side of the window, an innovation of their Dutch ancestors, glass cleverly angled so that one could spy on the street while seeming to look away.
"You shouldn't perform for them, Anne. It only encourages them."
Janie's mother looked narrow and pinched. She seemed in the lamplight like a portrait of herself, flat and grim. She turned away from the window, letting her eyes rest full on her niece.
"But then we do know how much you love theater."
The color rose in Anne's cheeks. Or maybe it was just the snap of the cold. Cold and scandal. Janie turned quickly away before they could turn their ire on her. Was this how other people were, afraid to admit grief, causing pain rather than be comforted? Or was it only the Van Dyvel household? Bay hadn't been like that. Bay would have diffused the situation with a joke for Anne, a hand on his mother's arm. But Bay was gone. Anne sank into a chair, a sinuous movement even in her stays.
"You have to give the vultures something. If they're talking about Teddy, they might not..."
With a convulsive gesture, Anne's fingers closed around the slim gold case hanging from a chain at her waist.
"Does anyone else need a cigarette? Janie?"
Janie ducked her head, an instinctive gesture.
"Not in my house," said Mrs. Van Dyvel coldly.
"Even Ruth Mills smokes them these days, Aunt Alva, and she's a Livingston."
Anne's voice was its usual drawl, but her hands gave her away, shaking so badly she could hardly work the clasp on her cigarette case.
"Isn't that so, cousin dear?"
"So I've heard," said Janie cautiously.
She wouldn't know. She'd never been invited to any of Ruth Mills's house parties at Statsburg. Janie went where her mother went, to select gatherings of the elect,
parties that wouldn't be sullied by the new people and their conspicuous expenditure. And, of course, to Illyria. A silly name for a house, her mother had sniffed, but it was what Annabel and Bay had chosen to call it. Bay. The lamplight dazzled Janie's eyes, refracting into the light of a thousand icicles. The snow had thickened after they found him, crusting his body with diamonds, turning him into a creature out of fancy, a sleeping prince waiting to be woken. "Janie!" Her mother's voice was sharp.
"I'm sorry, I was..."
"Not attending. You never do. Go see what's keeping the girl. You'd think she was harvesting the tea herself." Anne rose from her chair with something less than her usual grace. The cigarette was still clutched, unlit, between her fingers. Even she didn't quite have the gall to light it in the face of direct objection. "I'll go."
"No, it's all right."
The parlor felt like the inside of a coffin, velvet-lined. Janie could feel herself smothering in it.
"I won't be a moment."
She escaped before Anne could object. If there was one skill Janie had learned over the years, it was the art of absenting herself. One could be absent in the midst of a crowded drawing room if one really tried. If the parlor was a coffin, the hall felt like a tomb, the marble floor cold and bleak, the frieze of urns that skirted the ceiling disappearing into the gloom. Janie escaped gratefully to the nether regions of the house, down the half-stair that led to the kitchen. She could feel the warmth even before she entered, warmth and coal smoke and the strong smells of food in various stages of preparation.
"Is something burning?" asked Janie.
"The cakes!" Mrs. O'Malley started up from the table, grabbing for a towel and catching up a news sheet instead. She stared at it as though not sure how it had got there.
"I was just..."
"Yes, I can see that."
"Double murder on the Hudson," shouted the headline. Somewhere they'd found pictures of Annabel and Bay. Neither looked at all like themselves. Annabel's was an artist's sketch, her hair piled high atop her head in a style she didn't favor, her chin pushed into an unnatural position by the strands of a pearl choker Janie couldn't recall her ever wearing. And then there was Bay. Janie recognized the picture, taken on the occasion of his graduation from the Harvard Law School 6 years before, his hair slicked down at the sides, high collar stiff around his throat. The same picture that sat in a silver frame on a table in the parlor. Someone in the house must have provided the picture. Mrs. O'Malley? Or Katie, the downstairs maid? Katie was standing by the scullery, holding herself as though her very stillness would keep her from notice. Janie nodded at the news sheet.
"You'd best not let Mrs. Van Dyvel see you with that."
Mrs. O'Malley clutched the paper close to her thin chest.
"Yes, miss. No, miss."
Janie had always wished she could be like a girl in a story, the sort of girl who was beloved by peers and servants alike. But she had never had the gift of commanding allegiance, either by love or by fear. The servants, she knew, took their cue from her mother. Janie was an extraneous female, but a Van Dyvel still, to be treated with nominal respect to her face and derision behind her back. Janie held out a hand.
"May I?"
Mrs. O'Malley surrendered the news sheet. The print was grainy, smeared by the touch of eager fingers, and this was only one of many newspapers being hawked on street corners. Not since the discovery of a dismembered body in the East River 2 summers ago had there been such a sensation. Murder. Janie still couldn't make her mind close around the word. Murder was something that happened in the tenements of Hell's Kitchen, in the dark segments of the city through which a carriage passed with closed curtains. Not in her family. Not in Illyria.
"I'll dispose of this," said Janie,
and was aware of just how much she sounded like her mother. A movement by the door caught her eye. A man, behind Katie, in the narrow passage between the scullery and the street. Sharply, she said,
"And who might this be?"
Katie cast an agitated glance at Mrs. O'Malley.
It's my cousin, Jimmy.
The man unfolded himself from the wall, stepping into the light, the gas lamp casting a reddish glow against his black hair, setting shadows beneath his cheekbones. He held his cap in one hand. The other hand he extended to Janie.
My condolences for your loss, Miss Vandyvel.
Janie kept her own hands pressed close to her sides.
This is not a time to be receiving callers, even cousins.
If he was one, the ink on his fingers said otherwise. The byline on the article in Janie's hands read James. James Burke. James Burke. The name sounded oddly familiar, as though she had heard it before. On the pages of a news sheet? The family didn't read those sorts of papers, but it was hard to ignore them entirely, plastered as they were across the city. Janie pressed her eyes shut, seeing the glare of the gaslight against the inside of her lids.
It would be a great deal less painful if people would respect that loss.
The interloper met her eyes, unabashed.
Surely truth should be a consolation to the family, Miss Vandyvel.
Do you call this truth, Mr. Burke?
He didn't deny the charge. Instead, he inclined his head in something that was almost, but not quite, a bow.
Truth comes in all forms, Miss Vandyvel.
On his tongue, the use of her name sounded impossibly intimate.
But seldom in the news of the world. I take it that you are the person responsible for perpetrating this nonsense?
The man had the gall to widen his eyes in innocence.
We prefer to call it investigative reporting, Miss Vandyvel.
I call it scandal-mongering, pure and simple.
Janie was too angry to be shy. All she could think of was Viola and Sebastian in their nightclothes, crying for their mother. They were too young to understand what was being said. But what if when they were older? It was easier to fling mud than to scour a reputation clean.
Making capital out of the suffering of innocent souls?
Mr. Burke leaned one hand familiarly against the back of a chair.
And isn't that the same way most of your friends on Fifth Avenue made their fortunes?
That's not...
That was what he wanted, to keep her talking. She'd find her own words flung back at her in the press, twisted and distorted. Stiffly, Janie said,
"This is a house of mourning. I would urge you and your colleagues to remember that."
To Katie, she added,
"Mrs. Vandyvel is waiting for her tea."
Katie bobbed a curtsy.
"Yes, ma'am."
Janie kept her attention fixed on Katie, her voice prim.
"I trust you will, in the future, restrict your family reunions to your half-day. They have no place in this kitchen."
She sounded like her mother. No, worse, she sounded like a sour spinster, tyrannizing the staff to mask her own powerlessness. Mr. Burke stepped forward, a knight-errant in a shabby gray suit.
"It's not Katie's fault."
"In which case it must be yours."
Janie turned her displeasure where it belonged.
"This discussion is over, Mr. Burke. You are disrupting the household and keeping Katie from her duties."
"And we mustn't have that."
Mr. Burke's eyes met hers, the gray-green of moss over stone.
"Good day, Miss Vandyvel."
"Goodbye, Mr. Burke."
His only reply was a tilt of his cap as the door closed behind him. A hint of French perfume warred with the scent of burning crumpets.
"Who was that?"
Janie turned hastily, blinking at Anne in the kitchen door.
"No one. One of Katie's cousins."
Anne shrugged, already losing interest. She looked out of place in the domestic confines of the kitchen, her taffeta gown too rich, her blonde hair too bright for workaday use.
"Aunt Alva wants her tea sent to her rooms, sometime this century."
Mrs. O'Malley sprang into action, assembling a tray with more force than grace.
"You're to go to her."
Anne waved one long white hand at Janie. When you're done with your reading. Janie had forgotten the paper. Her fingers tightened around the page as she hurried after Anne up the stairs.
I was simply disposing of it.
Whatever you like. Anne's tone was derisory, but Janie didn't miss the glance she darted at the paper. Janie would have laughed if it hadn't been so miserable, all of it, to be reduced to reading the scandal sheets for word of one's own family. Somewhere along the sides of the frozen river, the search went on for Annabelle's body. Or so they presumed. Their sensibilities, it seemed, were too delicate to be imposed upon by the police. Whatever they knew of their own tragedy came at third hand. They were starved for news, all of them, as isolated as Robinson Crusoe on his island. Anne, with all her tricks and her charm, Janie's mother with her lineage and her money, all of their powers were reduced to nothing when it came to the workings of the masculine world of the law. Janie looked anxiously at her cousin.
What happens next?
Anne deliberately misunderstood her. Supper, I should think. Janie pressed her eyes shut, schooling herself to patience. Grieving came upon people in different ways, and if it made Anne even more prickly than usual, well, there could be no doubt that she was grieving, or that she had the right to grieve. If there had been one person in the world who Anne truly loved, it was Bay. There were times Janie had wondered if there might be something more between her brother and her cousin, if the rumors of Annabelle's affair with the architect were just a screen for... No. Janie bit down hard on her lower lip. Now she was being as bad as the scandalmongers howling at the gate. Bay had loved Annabelle. If Janie was sure of anything, she was sure of that. Not the fevered love the papers meant to convey, something harsh and jealous, but a comfort with their own company, the intimacy of a hand on a shoulder in passing, a message conveyed with a look. Words might lie, but not that. Janie paused at the foot of the stairs, stopping Anne with a fleeting touch to her arm, the most contact they had had in weeks.
What they're saying, Bay would never have done that. He would never have hurt Annabelle, not Bay.
Because you knew him so well. Anne had always known just where to slide the knife. Janie forced herself to honesty, even if honesty felt raw and painful.
I wish I had.
Ever since she was little, all she had wanted was for her brother to notice her. It wasn't that Bay was particularly outgoing. His smile was a slow thing, his wit quiet. But there had been something about that very reserve that had promised riches to those admitted to the inner circle. That would never happen now. Bay was gone, and all his subtle charm with him. Janie would never be privy to his confidences, never have him turn to her as he had to Anne. Except that once, at the last, when his lips had spoken a name she didn't know. Janie stood at the bottom of the stairs, one hand on the newel post. She felt foolish asking, but if anyone would know, it would be her cousin.
Anne?
She asked.
Who's George?
London, 1894. February.
Fancy a free supper?
Kitty popped into Georgie's dressing room without knocking, banging the door cheerfully behind her. Georgie eyed her friend in the streaked glass of her mirror.
What is it this time?
Kitty adjusted her hat, frowned at the results, and tweaked it again, examining herself this way and that.
Not what, who? A Sir something and his rich American friend.
Kitty had removed the wig she wore as Mariah in the Ali Baba's musical evisceration of Twelfth Night, but her cheeks were still streaked with red, her face lavishly painted and powdered. Coupled with her feathered hat and new crimson brocade walking dress, it made her look, thought Georgie, like the more prosperous sort of streetwalker. Picking up a cloth, Georgie scrubbed vigorously and ineffectually at the grease paint on her cheek. It was a bad job, she knew. No matter how much cream she used, how much soap, it never entirely came off. She went into each performance with the shadow of the last beneath it.
How can you tell the American is rich?
Kitty winked at her in the mirror.
Aren't they all?
The ones who showed up in London were, at any rate, and London was the entirety of Kitty's world. There must, Georgie was quite sure, be poor Americans, struggling Americans, ordinary humdrum Americans. But they weren't the ones who showed up at the stage door of the Ali Baba, eager for a little old-world decadence.
I don't know. We have a matinee tomorrow.
Georgie didn't fault Kitty for supplementing her income. Anyone who had lived as she had knew you did what you must to pay the rent. But it made her uncomfortable all the same.
Here, let me.
Kitty obligingly yanked the tapes of Georgie's corset closed and began hooking up the back of her dress. Georgie's dresser was meant to do that, but she had sloughed off the previous week, complaining about the size of her pay packet. They'd been playing to half-empty houses for the past 6 months, and it was beginning to show. They were already dressing themselves. They'd be making their own sets next.
I just need you to entertain the friend.
What kind of entertainment?
Nothing like that, I promise. It's just a meal, that's all.
Kitty hooked the last hook and stepped back, her eyes meeting Georgie's in the mirror.
A girl needs to fill her stomach somehow.
And the show wouldn't run much longer. Kitty didn't need to say it. It was there in the dusty dressing room, in the empty seats out front, in the desperation beneath Kitty's crooked smile.
All right, said Georgie slowly.
Champagne was better than stout any day, particularly if someone else was paying. A lady would blush at dining with strange men, would balk at the implied cheat of taking something for nothing. But she wasn't a lady, was she? She was an actress. She showed her legs for a living.
Where are they taking us?
The Criterion, said Kitty with satisfaction.
Georgie narrowed her eyes at her as she slid off the stool.
Let's hope your American is as rich as you claim.
Your American? Kitty retorted. I have my eye on the Toff.
Georgie grabbed her old coat.
Whatever you say, Lady Kitty.
Go on,
said Kitty, but the way she preened at the words made Georgie wish she'd kept her mouth shut. Kitty held out a flask to her.
Just a nip.
Kitty had taken a nip already. Georgie could smell the gin on her breath, gin and the cloves to hide it. Add a bit of orange peel and she'd smell like Christmas punch. It wasn't an escape to which Georgie had resorted, not yet. But there were times when she understood the appeal of it, particularly now, with the chill of winter permeating the drafty back areas of the theater, and the slush seeping through the thin soles of her boots. But they didn't know these men.
I'd rather keep my wits about me.
Such as they were. But they'd got her this far, hadn't they? She'd survived. There was something to be said for surviving.
Suit yourself.
Kitty took her nip, and then another. Reluctantly, Georgie asked,
Had you ought to, Kit?
Kitty shrugged.
The cold gets in your bones, doesn't it?
She shoved the flask back in the hidden pocket of her coat before pushing open the side door and tumbling out into the cold. Two men waited in the alley, tall hats pulled low over their brows, the points of their cigars glowing red in the gloom. Their heads were bent close together, their voices low. They appeared to be engaged in some sort of whispered dispute, all the more vehement for being so quiet. Georgie could feel the door handle cold and hard against her palm, the cold burning through her gloves. After all this time, she hadn't thought about him in days, weeks, but he'd said he'd find her, hadn't he? She knew that silhouette. She could see it beneath her eyelids when she went to bed at night, looming over her in the half-light, pressing her against the wall. That smell,
The smell of bay rum cologne. The tall hat, the caped coat. That coat flapping around his legs as he thrust against her. He hadn't even bothered to take off his coat that day. She could still hear the susurration of it. Back and forth, back and forth. Run, 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 Georgie's senses screamed. If she moved quickly, she could be away into the warren of corridors in the back of the theater, up into the machinery that skirted the stage. But she couldn't seem to make her legs move. She could smell the tang of Kitty's gin, the acrid reek of the men's cigars. She could feel the pinch of a blister on her heel, the bruise on her side where she'd been hit by a piece of falling scenery. She was awake. Awake and frozen. Breathlessly, Kitty called.
I've brought her!
The two men turned, and Georgie's breath came out in a rush that created a cloud in front of her face. It wasn't Giles. This man was taller, broader, the hair beneath his hat fairer. It was a stranger who stood there. The shorter man tossed away his cigar, ground it beneath his heel, and sauntered forward to take Kitty's hand. The other man stayed behind, in the shadows. Georgie could feel the clammy sweat in the small of her back, under her arms. She struggled to control her breathing. It was the caped coat that had made her imagine more. The caped coat and the red glow of a cigar in the gloom. It wasn't Giles. It wasn't Giles. In a Mayfair drawl, the man with the dark mustache pressed a kiss to the back of Kitty's hand.
Madame Caterina?
That's Miss Frumley to you, my lord,
said Kitty with mock severity. Kitty's real name wasn't Frumley at all. It was, she had confided to Georgie, Potter. But Frumley sounded better on the bills in the front of the theater, more aristocratic, like those earls of what's-their-name. And Georgie hadn't the heart to tell Kitty that the family whose name she had borrowed spelled it Fulmondeley.
And this is Miss Evans.
Kitty displayed Georgie like a prize, dragging her unwillingly forward.
Georgie, this is,
Hugo. Hugo Medmenham. You may call me Sir Hugo.
With a mocking bow, he gestured towards his companion.
Ladies, may I present to you Mr. Bayard Van Dyvel of our former colonies.
Ladies, murmured the man who wasn't Giles.
Now that he had stepped into the uneven light of the lamp over the stage door, Georgie could see that they were nothing alike. Tall, yes, and broad in the shoulders, but there any resemblance ended. Giles had affected long chestnut sideburns that curled beneath his ears and a cavalryman's mustache. This man was clean-shaven, the lamplight making the fair hair that curled beneath his collar glow the color of old gold. But Georgie hung back all the same. Foolish as she knew it to be, the old fear still gripped her, tightening her chest, constricting her throat. It wasn't Giles, she told herself again. It wasn't Giles. Kitty lowered her lashes, speaking in tones of exaggerated refinement that made Georgie wince for her friend.
Charmed, I'm sure.
Tucking her cold hands beneath her armpits, Georgie nodded curtly in greeting. Sir Hugo possessed himself of Kitty's gloved fingers, drawing her to his side.
What are you waiting for, Van Dyvel? Do they not teach you manners in America? Miss Evans wants an escort.
Miss Evans did not, in fact, want anything of the kind. What Miss Evans wanted was to pull her hat down about her ears and walk as rapidly as she could to her boarding house. A free supper was one thing, Sir Hugo another. She'd heard of him before, the sort who still believed in the droit du seigneur. Toss a few coins on the bed afterwards and think the girl honored by his attentions. There'd never been charges brought, but there wouldn't be, would there? The juries of the world were made of men. A man could hold his honor dear in masculine matters such as gambling debts, and never mind that he left a trail of ruined women behind him. Men diced with coin. Women diced with their lives. Kitty was already walking off ahead,
her arm twined cozily with Sir Hugo's, leaving Georgie no choice but to follow. Mr. Van Dyvel reluctantly extended his arm. Georgie placed her fingers gingerly on his sleeve.
"I am afraid I didn't quite catch your name, Mr. Vanderville?"
"Van Dyvel." His voice was warm and rich, the vowels strange to Georgie's ears. Strange, but not unpleasant. "It's Dutch."
"Devil's spawn,"
contributed Sir Hugo with a grin. He leaned closer to Kitty, saying with mock solicitousness,
"Don't be alarmed, my dear. He seldom swallows more than one soul a night."
Chapter 2. London, 1894. February. The street was too narrow to walk all abreast. Georgie and the man who wasn't Giles fell behind, walking in silence for several moments before Mr. Van Dyvel said quietly, "All that about the devil, you must forgive my friend. He didn't mean to be blasphemous. I'm afraid he's, well, not used to mixed company." "Not used to mixed company?" Either Mr. Van Dyvel was very green, or he thought she was. Georgie shrugged. "We've heard worse, Kitty and I. Shakespeare's full of ribald humor."
"Country matters?" said the American.
Oh, the phrase sounded innocent enough, but it didn't fool Georgie for a minute. She'd acted that scene last year, Hamlet propositioning Ophelia in the crudest possible of ways. Subtle in the original, less subtle as it had been acted at the Alibaba. She could still hear the catcalls from the audience, drunken gentlemen half tumbling from their boxes as they offered to take Hamlet's place on stage. Of course, that had been when they'd still had gentlemen in the boxes, before the new musical comedies had begun stealing their audience and their income. Best to nip any country matters in the bud. Georgie quickened her pace, forcing the American to lengthen his stride in response.
"As long as you're not offering to put your head in my lap."
Mr. Van Dyvel ducked his chin into his collar.
No, it was just, Hamlet.
"A man who came to a bad end," said Georgie pointedly.
Mr. Van Dyvel looked down at her with interest. His eyes were a curious pale blue, like shadows on snow.
"Would you say that? You could say it was a good end, avenging his father's death."
Georgie snorted.
"At the cost of all of Denmark, not to mention his mother and his bride. Seems a bit much, doesn't it?"
Mr. Van Dyvel slowed his steps as he thought about it.
"You could argue that he was expunging a stain, purging the corruption from society."
"By killing it off?"
There was something heady about the way he was listening to her. Really listening.
"That's throwing out the baby with the bathwater."
"Well, metaphorically."
"It's hardly a metaphor when the stage is covered with bodies."
"The bodies of people who never were,"
pointed out Mr. Van Dyvel.
"It's all a fiction."
"What's Hecuba to him, or he to Hecuba, that he would weep for her?"
quoted Georgie in exaggerated tones.
"But he does weep for her, that's the point."
"As I recall, that wasn't quite the point,"
Mr. Van Dyvel began, but Georgie swept his objections aside.
"If the characters aren't made real to you, if you don't mourn for them when they fall, why watch the play?"
"For the poetry?"
A slow smile spread from Mr. Van Dyvel's eyes down to his lips.
"You are a passionate advocate for your art, Miss Evans."
"And you," thought Georgie, "are a far more accomplished flirt than you seem."
"I was merely passing the time."
Georgie drew her arm from Mr. Van Dyvel's, ostensibly to fix the angle of her hat. She looked up at him from under the brim.
"I'm afraid we've been lumbered with each other, so we'd best make the best of it."
"I wouldn't say, that is, I'm quite enjoying..."
Mr. Van Dyvel's eyes caught hers, and he made a helpless gesture.
"This whole evening has been something quite out of the common. Hugo told me we were seeing Shakespeare."
Georgie smiled without humor.
And so it is. Shakespeare ground up like sausage and about as appetizing.
It was the Alibaba's specialty. Shakespeare with song, blank verse transformed into ribald rhymes, a nudge and a wink.